Welcome to Raiders of the Lost Podcast, one of the fastest growing movie podcasts in the world, where we discuss all things film. On this episode, we discuss The Prestige. Released in 2006, directed by Christopher Nolan, written by Christopher and Jonathan Nolan, based on the novel by Christopher Priest.
What's up, movie friends? Welcome back to the show. This is Anthony.
And this is James, and we're stumbling back into Chris Nolan's world. We're going to be doing The Prestige, which is one of our favorite Nolan films, which seems to get hidden inside his incredible filmography, but it's a gem.
We were itching to do another Nolan movie.
Oh, every time we do Nolan, I get so giddy and excited. We're the biggest fanboys.
Yeah, we've discussed Dark Knight, Inception, and Dunkirk, all of them, and Tenet. Prestige a little bit before, but we were like, let's dedicate a whole episode to The Prestige.
It deserves one. It's a long film, but there's so much to go over, and it's very dense.
And like you said, he has such an incredible filmography that it gets lost in the shuffle, I think. But everyone we talk to loves this movie. We get comments all the time from fans saying how much they love this movie and asking us to do an episode on it. And everything we've posted in terms of social media content regarding The Prestige always performs well. So I think that even though this movie didn't make much money, it did make a profit. It was successful.
It's like $100 million on a $40 million budget, I believe.
I think in total, yeah. So not a huge, huge success, but for what it was, a period piece about magicians, like it did really well. And also it was up against another magician movie that same year, The Illusionist, came out with Edward Norton and Paul Giamatti and Jessica Biel. And that movie, they were coming out around the same time during Oscar season, and people were like, it's the battle of the magician movies, but The Prestige ended up being the far superior movie.
Yeah, its audience loves this film. Critically, it got 76% on Rotten Tomatoes, but it has a 92% audience score on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's surprising, the critic score.
Yeah, well, critics are haters for Chris Nolan, and they hate him. And then IMDb, it's 8.5, and it's a top-rated movie of all time, number 47 on IMDb's user list.
Wow, 47?
Which is insane when you think about it. But because Nolan also has The Dark Knight up there, and I'm sure Batman Begins is up there as well, maybe Inception.
Inception and Dark Knight are in the top 25.
Interstellar's up in the top 100, too.
How many movies does he have over 8-point rating on IMDb?
Probably half of them.
Maybe most of them.
Maybe half of them.
Because Dark Knight Rises is 8.2, and then
really?
Yeah, 8.2. I wonder how many he has in the top 50 of IMDb.
But either way, it's a very underappreciated film, and it got nominated for cinematography and art direction. But still, it's one of those movies where how doesn't this get acclaim for best picture nominations? Even the acting is terrific. I mean, Hugh Jackman gives it an incredible performance in this movie.
I think it's his best performance in his career.
It could be.
I really think so. Yeah. It's a very complex role, and he does a fantastic job because at this point, he was doing the X-Men, he was doing Wolverine, and we weren't really seeing him in anything else in terms of big major motion pictures.
Well, he was in the Aronofsky film.
The Fountain.
The Fountain.
But I believe that came out in 2005, so you're right. But other than that, like, that movie, no one saw it.
I
love that movie. It's great. It's awesome. And I think that people saw how talented he is, because he's a very, very talented actor. But because he did Logan like 10 times, it's like you kind of like he doesn't get that many juicy roles to play because he had dedicated like 15 years of his life to playing Logan. And that takes up a big chunk of his schedule. So he only has so many opportunities to do other films, which he, as he grew older, he was able to do like more films outside of the X-Men universe. But this is one of those where you got to see how talented the guy is.
Yeah, not to mention just from being a film actor, but a theatrical actor. He's a great singer and dancer and just overall performer. He's a very confident artist. And
Triple threat.
So like to see him bring his stage chops to a character that really needs it with Robert Angier, which we'll get into later on. It's just so great to see someone who really embodies that character already in their real life being a natural stage performer.
And what Chris Nolan began bringing to his movies with Batman Begins and with this movie is the casting. If you watch Chris Nolan movies, they're always cast with incredible actors.
Insomnia, too.
Yeah, Insomnia as well, but there's only two real leads, but Hilary Swank is in that, too. So, yeah, definitely Insomnia. So he really cares so much about casting, and the thing with him is I've read interviews where he says that if I cast an A-class act, like an A-caliber actor, like a best of the best, I don't have my job's done. All I have to do is shoot them, and they're doing their job because they're the best there is. They're the best at their game. So if I can get the best actors possible, most of my job is done. And he does that. His movies are always so well cast. That's what he changed with superhero genre, where he made the first Batman Begins movie, but it has an incredible cast. You got Oscar nominees. You got Gary Oldman. You got Michael Caine. You got these incredible established actors.
Liam Neeson.
Yeah, Liam Neeson. Like, this is a superhero movie, but he's casting some of the best actors alive.
Marvel is taking notes for Iron Man. All right, we need some stars in this movie.
Exactly.
We'll bring in Robert Downey Jr. and then Jeff Bridges. It's going to be great.
Yeah, exactly.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Where before that, it was superhero movies where, like, who's the hottest star around? And otherwise, other than the leads, the supporting actors weren't anyone to take note of. But then Nolan changed the game in terms of how you cast superhero movies, and now all of his films, especially The Prestige, are so impeccably cast, and that makes all the difference.
Yeah, I can hear how excited Anthony is to talk about this film, but let's slow down for a second. And before we continue, the best way to support Raiders of the Lost Podcast is to share us with your family and friends and become a patron at patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast. Patrons get perks like personalized videos, or you get to see our podcast schedules for upcoming episodes. Top tier patrons get a monthly shout out on the podcast, which we just did a few episodes ago. And the best perk of all is every single patron, no matter what tier of income you're contributing to the show, every patron has access to weekly bonus episodes on every Tuesday that only patrons can listen to and watch. Head on over to our website, RaidersOfTheLostPodcast.com, to check out all of our sources of content, our merch, our custom movie posters. Follow, subscribe wherever you're listening. Hit the notification bells. If you're watching on YouTube, subscribe. Leave a comment, hit the like button, and thank you so much for tuning in around the world, everybody. All right, you can go back.
And what another thing that Nolan brings to his films that he brought to Batman Begins and Insomnia is atmosphere. And atmosphere is so important. It's something that, like, David Fincher is really good at portraying, where it's when he's establishing the world and establishing the story. And it's not like what Nolan likes to do is he likes to shoot these really grand scale exterior shots. And it's oftentimes like helicopter shots showing these incredible environments and landscapes of the locations we're looking at, where most filmmakers don't really tend to do that too much. But he likes to expand the scope of the world, where you're not just in the scenes in these sets, but he's showing you where they are in the world. Like, there's these amazing shots of, like, the train in Colorado and in England and stuff. So there's great establishing atmospheric shots that he uses to set the tone and the visual style of the movie that he brought to, like, Batman Begins when in the first act, when he's doing these amazing helicopter shots of the glacier, you know, things like that, which really bring about the scope and make you feel like you're watching something grand.
Did the same thing with Insomnia.
Exactly.
It looks almost like the same glacier, probably.
Could be, yeah.
And The Prestige, in my opinion, is the rare example where the movie is better than the book. I've read the book. It's also very good, but it's very different too. And the way that the book plays out is it's really two halves. The first half is Alfred Borden and his diary and his POV of the story. And then the second half of the book is all Robert Angier and his diary and his POV of the story. And it kind of wraps everything up together towards the end. But what Nolan did is very similar to what he did with Batman Begins, where he tells this story out of order on purpose. And just like Memento, the opening scene is the final scene of the film, really. So not the hats, but the magic trick that Michael Caine shows the young girl. That's the end of the movie.
Yeah, and it can be a confusing movie on your first watch, but as you watch it on repeat viewings, you really get a grasp for what he's doing, how he's jumping around from time. And it can be confusing because of how often he does it. It's not like Pulp Fiction or even Batman Begins, where he does take a little time between the periods. In this movie, there are 146 cuts to different time periods, whether it's jumping backwards or forwards or even further backwards. And so, and there are three main different timelines going on in the film. And it's a little hard as an audience member, your first time taking it in, understanding the storyline and the plot going on at first, because there's a lot to take in. You're getting different narrators between Angier and Borden at different times in their lives, and then they're even talking to each other through the diary. So it can be a lot at first, but on repeat viewings, and when you get a grasp for what is going on, it really makes you appreciate the story and the writing as well.
It seems to be something that he sort of picked up from Pulp Fiction, obviously, in Tarantino style, but also Terrence Malick, where Terrence Malick does the same thing, where he can transport you years in the future, years in the past, to a memory with just a cut. But Nolan does it to an extreme in this film, especially.
Yeah, and it ends up being a strength of the film, because the mystery of what's going on is one of the strongest elements of the movie. Trying to understand, both these magicians, they have these secrets that they're hiding from one another and from the audience, and we both know, as an audience member, the first time watching it, you don't know what they are, but you're so intrigued by them, and you want to figure out what are they hiding, what is behind the curtain for both of them, and when as this movie is famous for having a really great twist and
multiple
multiple twists and a great ending, which really is paid off because it's established so well, and when the journey to getting to that twist and to that finale is so fantastic.
Yeah, and we'll journey through this episode getting to the finals this week because I think this film is such a great third act and twist reveal. We don't want to spoil it right away. We want to save it a little bit.
Not everyone has seen it.
Maybe if not everyone's seen it, they maybe don't fully understand it yet. And I think we just want to lay out the entire film to explain the ending a lot better. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about this with the story of these two feuding magicians in 1890s England, London, is Nolan's directing. His entire style of this film and directing, it's like he's performing a magic trick as well, like the magicians as well. He misdirects you. He shows you one thing instead of showing another. But he doesn't do it like a lot of lazy filmmakers do if they're trying to purposely hide information from you, which they could tell you earlier or give you hints at. But he sort of hides everything in plain sight. And like we've talked about with a lot of Nolan's films, except for obviously the Batman films, he generally tells you the rules of his movie in the first couple minutes, in the first few scenes, which he does in this movie. The opening shot of this movie is the hats, which is the prestige of the trick that Andrew eventually develops with Tesla, the magic trick, which is really a scientific experiment. But it's a great shot because it's the hats, but also the title, the prestige, is literally an example of what that shot is.
But without the context, it's just an image to us that we don't know. It has no meaning to
us.
So he's showing us what the finale is, but without the context and understanding what the image means or represents, we're at a loss. But then, because we've seen the image, when we see it again later in the film, we connect to it and we understand, oh, that's what the hats meant.
Exactly. But also following the hat shot, he goes into the cut scene of Cutter, who is the stagehand, basically, and the creator of the apparatus
for
the tricks.
Yeah, I can't remember. The term is hard to pronounce, the word. It's a French word.
He is doing the magic trick for the young girl who we don't know yet, who is Jess, and he performs the trick of the disappearing bird. And this trick, Nolan shows you, is a perfect metaphor for Angier and his trick later on. So he tells you the rules of the entire story. He's basically revealing the trick to us with the bird metaphor of what Michael Caine's doing.
And the bird's also a metaphor of Alfred as well.
Yes.
Which we'll get to when we finish with a spoiler-free part.
But I love the opening dialogue of Michael Caine's character, Cutter, of this film. And I'd just like to recite it for a moment, if that's cool with you.
Can you do a Michael Caine voice while you do it?
I think that would just take away from it because
I'm Michael Caine.
It'd be a terrible impression. Every magic trick consists of three parts or acts. The first part is called the pledge. The magician shows you something ordinary, a deck of cards, a bird, or a man. He shows you this object. Perhaps he asks you to inspect it to see if it is indeed real, unaltered, normal. But of course, it probably isn't. The second act is called the turn. The magician takes the ordinary something and makes it do something extraordinary. Now you're looking for the secret, but you won't find it because, of course, you're not really looking. You don't really want to know. You want to be fooled, but you won't clap yet because making something disappear isn't enough. You have to bring it back. That's why every magic trick has a third act, the hardest part, the part we call the prestige.
And essentially, you could say that is comparable to writing a screenplay, writing a story. You have three acts. You establish the story, then you have the meat and potatoes in the middle, in which you have the conflict and the driving action, and then you bring it all together with the finale and the third act and the climax. So a magic trick very much falls in line with how you would write a story traditionally.
And magicians, they're such a fascinating profession throughout the last two centuries of human existence and culture. You know, they were kind of rock stars at this time. They were really popular. They're the biggest theatrical act that you could go see, really. And it's so interesting to combine that with film because early filmmakers were illusionists and magicians in a way. You would go see these little mini short films. You know, the Lumiere brothers were very famous for this too, where they would show these films, but they were like illusions. Like someone would be disappearing into frame or coming out of frame, and there'd be impossible things that never seen before, but it's really just simple film tricks. So it's so cool to watch this story play out on film.
I think that's why Nolan really gravitated to the story as a way of showcasing how similar film and magic is, because film essentially is illusion. You're the crafting of a story on film and now on digital as well is the art of illusion, and the audience is taking in the illusion of the story before them. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm.
And I would say the main theme of this film is obsession, but also
secrets
and also cost. And like the what they say multiple times throughout the film, Tesla says it,
sacrifice,
but also the cost of a good trick or the price of a good trick. You know, have you considered the cost of what you want? Whereas Andrew doesn't understand what Tesla means, but Tesla's like, have you understood the cost? He's trying to let him know that, like, what this could do to you, your humanity.
Misguided ambition.
Yeah.
They're both very ambitious men, and they both go to extremes to achieve their goals and accomplish what they set out to do. Whereas Alfred, we won't get to it yet, but he doesn't do anything nefarious or you could say evil, whereas Angier becomes a much darker person by achieving his goals.
Well, they do both do nefarious things. Yeah. So not in terms of what Angier does to that level, but they do get into this feud of sabotaging each other's magic acts after the death of Angier's wife that Borden may have caused, that they don't know fully if he caused, but probably did cause. But she also agreed to the type of knot that he wanted to tie.
Yeah, exactly. But they weren't supposed to do that knot. Yeah. And for some reason, Alfred doesn't really fully know. Half of him thinks he did one knot, half of him thinks he did the other knot.
How could he not know?
How could you not know?
It's like his mind is divided. He's a troubled person, which we'll get into more. But let's get into the characters first before we get into the plot of the film. And the first one I think we should talk about is Robert Angier, played by Hugh Jackman. And so Robert Angier is a great performer, but a very mediocre magician. And the thing that I think Nolan did that was really interesting with this character is he gave him an American accent, whereas in the book, I'm pretty sure he's also English because Angier, they only hint at this with really two lines in the film. He comes from nobility. In the book, I believe his brother became a duke of a region of the UK and that he eventually was that. So really, Angier is a fake personality for Lord Caldlow. Lord Caldlow is who Robert Angier really is. That's why early on his wife says, like, this is why you hide your theatrical...
You have a different name.
Yeah, you hide from your family because you don't want them to... Or he says he doesn't want them to see his theatrical performances.
Oh, okay.
So he's really hiding from his family. They don't get into it.
So he really is a lord.
So he really eventually becomes a lord. That's who he really is. But Robert Angier is his fake personality so that he doesn't look like he comes from privilege.
Tarnish the family name.
But he does come from extreme privilege and wealth. That's why he always seems to have a lot of resources compared to...
And he dresses really well.
Yeah,
you can tell the difference between the way he dresses and Borden dresses. They have completely different incomes.
But I think it was really clever for Nolan to give this character an American accent because it makes American audiences relate to it more. It probably increased the potential profits of the film as well.
Also, the American accent is probably a fake accent. It's a fake accent for him.
It could be.
So he's always performing in front of everyone as Robert Angier.
Could be. But I don't think we know that for sure for him. I think Borden's more of the lifetime illusionist.
Yeah, but that's a point. But also, if he really is Lord Caldlow, how do you say it exactly?
Caldlow.
Caldlow. Then he probably naturally has a British accent.
Well, no,
accent.
That's in the book, so I think he just creates the persona of Lord Caldlow in the movie. So
it's a reference.
Yeah, I think that's just one mini thing that really the book really does differently.
Gotcha.
That I'll talk about for the movie. I don't want to ruin the book for anything. But so that's the real difference between Angier and Borden is Angier, again, mediocre magician but terrific performer.
Whereas Alfred is a terrific magician and a mediocre performer.
Terrible performer.
Where he can't sell his tricks. He seems to, when he's on stage performing, he doesn't seem to have the passion he has for magic that he has on his own when he's in private working in his workshop. He seems to be much more happy on his alone in the workshop, making tricks, building the sets and stuff, where when he's performing in front of a crowd, he doesn't seem to be enjoying it.
That's such a great point, because especially when he's with Sarah and he's with her nephew and he does the little magic tricks for them, he's so excited and elated by what he's doing.
Yeah, but like when he's in that bar in downtown and he does the bullet trick, like before that he's doing the rings and he has like this really stern face and he's not enjoying the experience of doing the magic, even though he's clearly not happy to be doing magic in like a backroom bar. But you have to start somewhere, and clearly, if you perform like that with a lack of a personality, you're never going to get ahead.
And the same thing happens to him even when he reveals his great trick, the Transported Man, for the first time, where no one claps because the trick was performed so poorly, even though it's one of the greatest tricks anyone's ever seen. It's like, well, what just happened? I can't even react to
that. It was hard to even accept or even understand what was going on because he just did not... and he didn't talk it up.
Yeah, and these two were colleagues who worked as basically assistants for another stage magician. But as we learn from Borden, like that magician, he's gotten too comfortable, he's too successful, he's not taking any risks. And it shows that they both have tremendous ambition for young magicians of their age.
And I really like the scene when when Michael Caine's character Cutter sends them to see that magician, that Chinese magician,
Chung Li Su,
and to watch his magic goldfish trick, and it seems to be an impossible trick for anyone to handle. And this is where you can see the difference between Alfred and Angier in terms of Alfred really understanding magic and the creation of a magic trick much better than Angier, where he's immediately spots when Chung Si Lu exits the theater and goes to his carriage. He's walking very gingerly. He seems to be very elderly, but Alfred immediately points out that this is the act right here. He lives the act. He understands that in order to sell this magic trick, it only works if the public thinks that he can barely even lift that fishbowl.
He has to live his entire life as the act. And I think Alfred understands this because he himself has been living an act for his entire life as well, which we'll get to soon.
Exactly.
And then they both have love interests as well. And the first one that we are introduced to is Julia, who's played by Pepper Parabo. And she is Angier's wife, and she is the stage assistant for the magician that they all work for. And she has the horrific death of drowning in that tank after Borden ties that knot that isn't a wet knot that Cutter tells him not to do, but he and Julia insist that it will work and they can do it and they think it's a better knot.
Because if they want a stronger knot to hold her up, because the other knot is almost slipping every time she goes up in the hook.
Yeah, but Cutter is trying to let them know that it's not a wet knot, meaning the rope's going to swell more and she'll not be able to slip it in the tank, which is what happens.
This is a really great scene, and Cutter trying to break through the tank with an axe, it's really tragic and intense, and when she spills out onto the floor, and Hugh Jackman does a great job performing the scene. He's fantastic in it.
And this is the event that sets these two friends and colleagues, well, not exactly friends, but colleagues, on these paths of sabotaging each other's lives forever, especially Angier, who always for the rest of his life wants to constantly get revenge against Alfred, but he never even satisfies that quench, whereas Alfred is more just reacting to the acts of Angier.
Yeah, and also it gets to the point where Angier becomes so obsessed with the transporter man that Alfred has invented that he refuses to accept anything, any kind of explanation that Cutter gives. Any kind of explanation that Scarjo's character
Olivia
gives, even though she ends up working for Borden and sees behind the scenes, he refuses to accept anything other than the impossible, and he becomes obsessed with Borden's magic.
Exactly. And then there's Sarah, who is played by Rebecca Hall, and she is Alfred Borden's eventual wife in the film, and she's a great character because she brings normalcy to Borden's life, but also we see this. Throughout the film of
duality,
throughout this relationship and marriage, it starts to crumble and break down emotionally for Sarah, especially because she can't deal with the secrets. Because again, Alfred is someone we learn is living his act every day of his life, and it's not fair what he does to Sarah. It's not fair what he does to Olivia. And same thing with Angier. It's not fair what he does to Olivia either. But these magicians, they risk everything with their ambitions, and they end up causing either all of the women in their lives to be pushed away from them, or they push them away from them themselves, or they die.
And also in terms of Alfred's personality, he seems to be one person one day and another person the other day, where she says, like, I can tell when you really love me and I can tell when you don't love me and you love magic more than me. And I think over the years it becomes a breaking point where she can't stand this duality to Alfred's personality, where it becomes impossible to maintain a marriage with someone who is who's one minute loves me and the next minute doesn't even want to be around me.
Yeah, and you can tell in the early parts of their relationship where the first time she brings it up, she actually brings it up as a positive, where like it actually makes the days where you say and you mean it a lot more meaningful to me. Whereas towards the end of the relationship, when she's coping with alcoholism and on the verge of suicide, she says that she can't take it anymore.
The days that you don't love me make it even worse.
Yeah. So it's what happens to her is she just mentally gets broken down by Borden's secrets and lies.
Mm-hmm. It's a tragic story for her. And then Michael Caine gives a terrific performance as Cutter. I think it's one of his best performances of the 2000s for sure. He's fantastic.
He has a huge role in this.
He has a lot to do in this movie. And I love how much Christopher Nolan uses him in his movies, because Michael Caine is one of the best actors of all time, hands down. He's sensational. And in this movie, he really carries a lot of the movie on his own.
And what's so fascinating about what we're talking about early on in the first act, where we're learning about these two young magicians, is before all this, the first act of the film, after the hats, after the magic trick with the young girl, we're watching the prosecution of Alfred Borden for the murder of Robert Angier. And this is such a fascinating way to set up this story because Angier is supposed to be dead.
And we watched it happen, and Alfred clearly didn't do it.
Yeah, Alfred's innocent for sure. He didn't kill Angier. He just watched him drown and tried to save him, which we eventually find out too. But it's such an interesting way to tell the story broken up like this, which I think it's when you do it effectively, like Nolan does, like Chris, like what Tarantino can do, it just adds so much more to the story. And like you said earlier, when we were talking about Kill Bill a few episodes back, if you did it perfectly chronological order, it wouldn't be that exciting of a plot. I think that's why Nolan did that, because as I told you with the book, it's really just here's this first half with all Alfred Borden, the second half's all Robert Angier. But when you mix it all together brilliantly like Nolan does and go back and forth between time, it's a really intriguing story.
Yeah, because if it was done chronologically, Angier wouldn't go to Colorado Springs until like an hour and a half into the movie.
For sure.
So the story is not even close to as compelling. And it's because of the mystery that he establishes with that kind of storytelling, which is the strength of the movie. The mystery of the story itself, like trying to figure out what they're trying to figure out, you know?
Yeah, and then we get on the story in the paths of how they both are developing their new tricks throughout their lives. And so Borden comes up with this brilliant trick that he says it's almost ready. It's not ready yet, but when the world sees it, it'll be what I'll be remembered for. And it's the transported man. And then once Angier goes to see the transported man, he comes back to talk to Olivia about it. He says it's the greatest magic trick he's ever seen in his life. But like you said earlier, when he's talking to Cutter about it, Cutter's telling him straight up how he does it. And what Cutter tells him is completely right. The only way he can do it, the only way I know how to do it is with a double. But like you said, Angier's so arrogant and so prideful, he thinks it's something more profound than that.
He thinks it's something inexplicable. And he wants it. Cutter says you want it to be something that is impossible, but it's not. But Angier can't get over the fact that he has duplicated the transported man, but he can't stand the fact that he has to take the applause. He has to hear the roar of the crowd from beneath the stage, and it's killing him and it's eating away at him because he seems to be at this point all about the glory. He wants the glory. He wants the crowd to be applauding him, and he wants to be able to see it happen, which is why he does not like how with this setup with the stage actor they have hired and altered to have an identical appearance to him. He does not like the setup of having to finish the act under the stage.
Yeah, one of my favorite parts about the script of Jonathan and Christopher Nolan's great writing is there are so many little lines of dialogue that foreshadow events to come. So what we're talking about is how after Angier goes and sees the transported man, now he decides, I'm just going to copy his trick. There's no point in being coy anymore. We're going to call it the new transported man. We're going to try to do it better because we're better performers. And since he's probably using a double, we'll just use a double as well. And this is actually foreshadowed early on where Angier says to Borden and Cutter while they're all just talking after one of the performances of the other magician, he says, any trick can be duplicated. So there's a ton of little lines like that that give you foreshadow to what's about to happen in the film.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That's great. There are a ton of little Easter eggs in this.
Oh, yeah, tons of them. If you're looking for them, are you watching closely?
Are you watching closely?
And so Cutter takes it upon himself because this is the only way Cutter knows how to do it. He's using a double, so we have to go out there and find somebody who looks like Angier, close enough to even just make him spiffy him up to make him look as much like Angier as we can. And it's great physical performance from Hugh Jackman as he plays Gerald Root, who is a not working stage actor. That's why he's so crazy, which Olivia jokes about. Of course he's insane. He's an out of work actor. But the physical performance of like the overbite of his character and like the big teeth and he's got like a different jawline that he's like sucking in. It's a really great physical performance by him.
And you can tell obviously it's Hugh Jackman, but I think they did a great job of establishing that. This is, you know, it's just someone who looks a lot like him. And then when Cutter's through with him, probably doing some kind of medical surgery on his face and then obviously dyeing his hair and training him, he could pass as Angier from a distance in the crowd.
So it's a great illusion. And when it comes to illusions, nothing is more impressive to your significant other than transforming that lockdown overgrowth you got into a pristine palace for them. Our friends at Manscaped have given you the secrets behind this magic trick with their fourth generation brand new Lawnmower 4.0. Head on over to manscaped.com and get the Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer using our coupon code RaidersOfTheLost at checkout for 20% off and free shipping. This brand new groomer is waterproof. It's skin safe. Anthony and I have both been using them for a few months now. They're terrific. It has a 7,000 RPM motor, which is super fast, wireless charger, built-in light, which is just groundbreaking addition to this thing. And fellas, if you're listening, get on manscaped.com, Get all their products. They're phenomenal. They're things you'll use for years to come. And there's 2 million men using their products worldwide right now. And they're currently shipping to UK, Canada, Europe, Australia, Singapore, and South Africa for their Lawnmower 4.0 groomer. So that's now expanded in terms of what countries you can get it in. So go to manscaped.com. Use our coupon code Raiders of the Lost at checkout for 20% off and free shipping for the greatest magic trick of your life.
And like we said, how Angier is a much better performer, even though they have the exact same trick, he dresses it up so much better. And plus, he has Olivia to help establish the trick. And his trick becomes more successful than Borden's, even though it's the same trick.
Yeah.
Like, it just is performed better. Throwing the hat, having the doors where you can see them from the perspective of the side angle, so you can clearly see there's nothing behind them at all. And so I think the way that he performs it is better, which is... But then also his hubris and his arrogance, like you said, he's a very arrogant person. It's what makes him send Olivia to Borden to steal his secret. And this hubris is the downfall of his trick and the cause of him breaking his leg, because Olivia felt betrayed by him and therefore betrayed Angier and became loyal to Alfred.
True, and that's how Borden sabotaged that trick for him to break his leg. But before that, what happens is they both sabotage each other's early acts. And so This is before Angier gets to that stage and he steals the transported man, where Alfred Borden, that trick's not ready yet to be performed. The transported man is not ready, so he's trying to do the bullet catch. He's trying to basically get his name known to London and be a great magician, just word of mouth.
The professor.
He's doing a bullet catch, which is such a daring thing, and he even shows Sarah that it's a safe thing, and like the only thing that could happen, like God forbid someone put a bullet in there, Sarah, but like other than that, it's a safe trick according to him. But he doesn't factor in the possibility that while he's performing the bullet trick and he asks for a volunteer to check that it's a real gun and to actually pull the trigger at him, that Angier would show up because he was still in his depressive being after the death of Julia, puts a real bullet in there and shoots Borden. But thank God his stagehand, what's his name? Fallon is there to push the gun almost out of the way, but it shoots Borden's hand. So now Borden has to deal with the reality that he's missing 2 fingers on one of his hands, and he's a magician, so there's only so much he can do now.
And Borden retaliates by sabotaging the caged bird trick that Angier has established in his new performance, and that lady gets her hands fingers broken and stabbed by that. Oh man,
because the cages are supposed to pull in, her fingers are stuck. So both of their first new acts are sabotaged by each other, and so this is a recurring theme in all of their futures together, as they're going to be constantly going at each other's throats for revenge.
Yeah, and then the transporter man is invented. But then after Olivia betrays Angier and becomes loyal to Borden, this is what drives Angier to capture Fallon and bury him alive.
But before that, I think it's important to talk about how, because Olivia is falling in love with Alfred, who she calls Freddy actually, she tells him how to find Gerald Root. And Borden gets to Gerald Root, and he's talking about, oh, I used to be a magician too. Oh, you're the great Danton, aren't you?
Of course I am.
But he's so good as a drunk. And he's telling him that I used to have an act too, and I used a double. But what I didn't realize is the double eventually learned that he has complete power over me.
Complete power, you say.
And so this leads to what he would obviously know as Gerald Root throwing a wrench into the entire act and starting to get more power over the situation. And then it allowed Borden to sneak into the act himself, sabotage it, come out from the other side of the trap door from below the stage, and just a perfect advertising for his show at the Pantages. Across the street, there's just too much magic on this stage.
Be easy on him. He does try so very hard. I love that scene. It's great.
It's really good. Tons of extras.
Yeah. But then this is what leads us to Nikola Tesla. And it's so I love when real life characters are put into fictional stories. I think it's so much fun and such an interesting way of writing. And having Nikola Tesla in this story adds so much to the film itself. I think it's fantastic having him in it.
Plus, David Bowie is playing Nikola Tesla.
And Nolan apparently only wanted Bowie and didn't want to cast anyone else. And Bowie turned it down. And so Chris Nolan flew out to him directly to have a personal one-on-one chat about the movie, and he eventually convinced David Bowie to accept the role. Because Nikola Tesla was such a larger-than-life personality. You need someone like that so when you see David Bowie in the role, and David Bowie being this icon, this larger-than-life personality, it fits Nikola Tesla.
Yeah, exactly. And so the way he learns about Nikola Tesla is when he buries Fallon alive after him and Cutter kidnap Fallon, which is pretty crazy.
And yeah, like that's pretty, I'm surprised Cutter went along with that.
But Cutter is also somebody who gets his hands dirty. And so that's the same thing where he's showing him that bird trick where Andrew's—
Get off the bloody stage!
Andrew's always been afraid to get his hands dirty. He doesn't have to with the bird trick, but Cutter just wanted to know that he could if he had to. Mm-hmm. So it was a test, really. It's like the Green Knight. And so he gets his hands dirty by burying Fallon alive with Cutter, and he gets the keyword to Alfred Borden's diary. And the keyword is, he wants the trick, and Borden explains to him the keyword is the trick. That's the explanation.
The keyword is the method, yeah.
And the keyword is Tesla. And so now Robert Angier takes this as, I have to go see Tesla because this crazy scientist obviously did something, made something for Angier to make his transporter man a possibility.
Exactly. And also, then this introduces us to Andy Serkis's character. It's always great to see him outside of the motion capture. And this is
Ali.
And this is early years for Andy Serkis. And he and Christian Bale actually starred in a few British films together. He was like supporting characters in that Hamlet production Christian Bale starred in.
I mean, he was
films.
Gollum, but like no one knew what he looked like.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Chris Nolan, being such a great filmmaker and understanding the talent that certain actors have, like, he knows Andy Serkis is one of the most talented actors alive, so I'm going to cast him in my movie.
Every character he plays, different person.
Exactly.
It's incredible. But yeah, he's such a great guy. But then it's so interesting to, again, watch Nikola Tesla, because the conversation that Tesla and Angier have when they're having lunch is really interesting, because they're talking about obsession. And it's something that we talked about earlier with Angier and Alfred Borden, where their obsession leads to really nothing but death around them and misery, even though they achieve their great magical acts and acclaim from London. But Nikola Tesla, throughout this film and throughout the creation of this apparatus for Angier, warns him multiple times of the cost of such a tool, or the cost of what it will cost you in terms of your humanity, and it'll bring you nothing but pain and dread.
Yeah, because it's you're this is not natural. This is not the natural order of things, what he's asking Tesla to do, to make a duplicate of him in order to pull off his own transported man. Like, this is unnatural law, and it shouldn't be. But Nikola Tesla, desperate for money because he's lost his funding, is willing to accept this job as a way to help fund his own research as well.
I also love that there's the factor of Edison and his men are kind of hovering around Nikola Tesla, because just like Borden and Angier and their intense rivalry, we get a glimpse or a hint at the rivalry between Edison and Nikola Tesla, which was immense. And obviously it seems like Edison ended up getting the upper hand and more power and maybe a larger impact on the world in terms of what he owned, because Edison, that company, it secretly is like a huge company.
Yeah, in the shadows.
Yeah, like people don't realize like Edison's huge.
It's not like his name just disappeared.
Owns a lot of stuff.
And Nikola Tesla, he wanted to make electricity free. That was one of the reasons why he was destroyed, and governments around the world were like, we have to charge for this. Like, this can't be a free commodity.
We have to produce it ourselves.
Yeah, so he was completely destroyed by the industry because of that.
But it's so cool because Nikola Tesla is referred to by Cutter and as a wizard. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, this was made by an actual wizard. And then even Ali, when he shows Angier the flashlights, Angier is like, this is real magic. I've found real magic, but he doesn't understand that. It's just
science. Light bulbs?
Yeah, the light bulbs in the field. What did I say?
Flashlights. You said that in my head. I was like, flash? What scene is he talking about? I was like, is there a scene with flashlights?
Thanks for picking up on that. I feel like in the back of my head, I was like, something didn't click right there. There's some code missing, bro.
I think that's the shot that got the Oscar nomination.
It was a beautiful shot.
Yeah, I think that shot right there with all the light bulbs in the field.
And really, again, it's just science. And another great example is when Tesla, when he first meets Angier, he's holding a light bulb. He's like, hold out your hand. He grabs it, and they're both, the energy in their bodies is creating the energy for the light to turn on.
Yeah, and also at this point, we're still trying to figure out, because it hasn't been expressed in terms in dialogue, what exactly Tesla is building for Angier. And they do a couple of tests on the hats with the electricity and nothing happens. So we're still trying to figure out what exactly does Angier want from him.
And at the same time as all these storylines going on, we're cutting backwards and forwards through time. We're also watching Alfred Borden rotting in prison, awaiting his execution. It's really fascinating because Angier has Alfred Borden's journal in Diary, which he had Olivia steal for him, which we eventually learned later on that Alfred Borden gave to Olivia to give to Angier. And also, Angier gave Alfred Borden his diary under the guise of Lord Caldwell to read in prison while he's there alone. And so they're both reading each other's journals and diaries, and we're also watching just... Like, the first time you watch this movie, is like, oh, Alfred Borden's a magician. He's obviously going to escape from prison somehow. It's just like, what's he going to do? And he pulls that trick on the guard by handcuffing his leg to the table and everything. So you think there's no way he's going to be hung. Mm-hmm. He's going to get out of there somehow.
But it gets to the point where it's like, there's no way out of that prison, even for a magician.
And his secrets to his tricks, the prestiges, are trying to be bought by the representative, Lord Caldwell. So Lord Caldwell kind of is blackmailing him in a way where he's going to offer that his daughter not be an orphan and that she'll be raised under his superstition, so she'll want for nothing for the rest of her life. She'll live a very privileged life in exchange for his secrets.
And what's cool about the diaries is they both wanted the other person to get the diary because they both end the diaries with a message directly to the other, whereas Alfred says, reveals that Olivia gave me the diary to give to you, Angier. And then Angier, likewise, in his diary, tells Borden, then, there you are, rotting in prison for my murder.
Which is crazy because he's supposed to be dead. And yeah. Alfred Borden can't believe it because I watched him die.
I watched you on a slab.
You were on a slab. How is it you're still alive? She needs to be with her father. Love Michael Caine.
The mind games in this movie are incredible. And then once the machine is finished and built... And
there's some tests that go wrong, yeah, that they think go wrong, which is really interesting because we still fully don't know what the machine does. But if you're paying attention and remember back to the first shot of the film, the first thing that they electrocute, you could say, or put inside of the machine is the top hat. And they try to test that multiple times, but they don't know what it does. And they try to do the cat later on, but continue with
it. But then it's a great reveal of how the machine works with the cat when the cat ends up getting in a fight and a tussle with another cat outside. And Gia follows the sound and he discovers that the cat is fighting what looks like an identical cat to itself. And he discovers there's got to be 50 top hats on the ground in that same spot. And this makes them all realize they are cloning these hats and they did clone this cat. It just happened to be the clone showed up where they didn't expect it to.
So clone is a word I think doesn't work with this. I think clone is the wrong word to use.
Sorry,
it's exact copies.
Yeah.
So
duplicate.
Duplicate as well. But I think just an exact copy of what it was. Whereas a clone is like you create another being.
Yeah.
Naturally,
physical form.
Yeah. But this is a literally exact copy of what that entity is.
Yeah. And we'll get to Angier where he ends up using this machine for the transported man. What is it called? He calls it the real transported man.
It's the new transported man, and then what's the final one? Does he call it?
I thought he calls it the real transported man.
I think it is the real transporter.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Which is ironic because it is really.
And what Angier is doing is the machine creates a duplicate. Like you said, it's not a clone. It's a literal duplicate of him. And so when the machine runs and another Angier appears, it is the same Angier. They're both the same thing. That Angier that just appeared has the same soul and mind and thoughts as the other Angier.
Up to the second that he was copied.
Exactly. And then once they appear, then they're having their own unique experience as opposed to the other Angier from that moment. But it's not like it's a physical copy of Angier that has no soul or mind or anything. It's literally two of the same thing.
Yeah, so that's something that really I think is a misconception about this movie. It's not clones. Again, it's an exact copy. That's why they have, up to that point, the exact same experiences. So like you said, perfect way you put it, exact same being.
Mm-hmm.
It's just unscientific or whatever.
This is what allows them to create the perfect version of the trick, because when Borden sees the trick in person and he looks up on the balcony when Angier appears, the duplicate Angier, he doesn't know yet, he sees that this really is the exact Angier, because all the other transporter mans, Borden was able to spot the problem immediately. Like the first Angier, he was able to see it. Yeah, he somehow shows up and he's drunk and overweight and like, how does he do it? It's a mystery.
But does he enjoy taking his bowels below the stage?
Yeah, so
no, it's killing him. It's eating him alive. He shares no he relishes in none of our success.
Exactly. Whereas at this moment, when he sees Angier on the balcony, he's like, he can tell that really is Angier because it is him.
Yeah, so he knows, because he knows that he uses a duplicate as well, that's not a duplicate. That is clearly Angier. He's not doing what I'm doing.
And then after that, he realizes that there's no way of ever understanding how Angier did it.
He eventually does later on at the end of the film. But so while Angier's setting up this new trick with Cutter, he wants Cutter for house only. He doesn't want Cutter to understand what he's gone, what depths he's gone to, and what he's doing every single night. We'll talk about it in a sec. But
that's why he has a blind crew.
Yeah, so he has a blind stagehands on purpose because he doesn't want anyone to see what's really happening below the stage. But at the time he's getting the show set up, he's going to have a limited engagement, 100 shows only, and then he's done. These are the tickets. This is the cost. It's going to make me a fortune, and then I'm gone forever. Alfred Borden's The Professor is killing. He's the biggest show in London. He's got acts every night, selling them out totally. But his relationship with Sarah is crumbling to the point where there's that fight they have at the restaurant while Alfred Borden's blindly
still
drunk
character,
and they're also with Fallon and Olivia, and Fallon takes Olivia home. But this eventually leads to Sarah's suicide because she can't take the secrets anymore. She can't take the constant performing, the constant lies, and she just ends up killing herself. It's so tragic.
Mm-hmm. It's tough for her, yeah. It's a tough life.
She went through a lot.
Yeah. I think that we should get into our intermission.
Oh,
and then,
yeah.
And then once we're done with the intermission, we can get into spoiler territory.
Yeah, for sure. But actually, our intermission is brought to you by MoviePosters.com, so tell us about that.
MoviePosters.com is the number one place to get your posters online today. Don't go to Amazon. I know they have free shipping, but it is not even close to the quality of MoviePosters.com. Use our special promo code Raiders15 to get 15% off your order today. If you're checking out our show on YouTube, which we hope you are, you'll see that it is covered with these amazing posters. They send us whatever we want. It's decorated. We love it.
They're the best.
If you're a fan of movies, if you're a fan of TV shows, there is no better way to express that love than by buying a bunch of posters and throw them up on your walls. Again, head on over to movieposters.com and use our promo code Raiders15 to get 15% off your order today.
Now to our intermission. I didn't realize we're like 45
yeah,
minutes
we're cruising.
In. We're having so much fun. We love this movie. So let's begin with our movie quote competition. Like usual, I have two, one from me and one from a fan. This one is from Joshua Mackey. Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Oh my God, what's this from? Oh, man.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just
like
your
opinion, man. I can't think of it. It's some kind of stoner.
Yeah.
I don't know it.
The Big Lebowski.
Oh, yeah. Shoot.
At the bowling alley.
Yeah, yeah.
Jesus. Jesus. I am Jesus.
When he licks it.
All right, and this one is for me. I used to produce... I'll do it in the voice. I used to produce movies in the... No, I can't do it. Never mind. I used to produce movies in the 80s. Kind of like action films, sexy stuff. One critic called them European. I thought they were shit.
Oh, man. Oh, my God. Hold on. Can you say it again?
I used to produce movies in the 80s. Kind of like action films, sexy stuff. One critic called them European. I thought they were shit.
I can't.
Drive.
Oh, my God. Bernie. Yeah, Bernie.
Albert Brooks' character.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's a great
quote. It's a good obscure one.
Yeah. All right, here's mine. It's two characters talking. You'll understand it once you hear what
hopefully.
It is. So character one says, "Hey, it's me." Character two says, "Prove it." Character one says, "You're a dick." Character two says, "Okay."
Oh. Oh, what is this? Oh, I know this.
Why am I thinking Simon Pegg?
Say it again.
"Hey, it's me. Prove it. You're a dick." Okay.
Oh my God, I'm drawing such a blank on this. Is it Shaun of the Dead?
No.
No, it's not Simon Pegg.
No.
I don't know why I'm thinking. What is it?
X-Men.
Oh, it's Hugh Jackman, yeah. Wolverine.
Yeah. Cyclops.
Cyclops. Oh my God, that is a great one. That's a great, great, great one. All right, guess this movie release year. Van Helsing.
Okay, hold on. 2006.
2004.
Oh, man. Wow, that's older than I thought it was.
Yeah.
Wow.
A couple years before this.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think we just disproved the fact that Hugh Jackman wasn't in any movies.
Yeah, I guess,
The
yeah.
Fountain
I
and so. Van Helsing. It's okay. Yeah. You just don't remember.
Yeah. I should just quit.
who wants to be take at these places? Co-host of Raiders of the Lost Podcast. We're taking auditions.
I'm done.
Send the tape to our Instagram DMs. Yeah. Of you talking about movies.
I'll give you my tablet and everything.
I'll choose a winner by the end of the month.
Yeah, yeah.
You can finish out the week. But clear your shit soon.
You're fired.
Actually, can you keep editing?
She's not going to pay me. Okay, my movie release year is the original The Italian Job. Starring Michael Caine.
This movie is so ridiculous. He sleeps with like five women in the first 30 minutes of this movie. It's ridiculous what they got away with in the 60s.
He's a player. Michael Caine probably did do that.
The first act of that movie, it's just like he's in a room with like five women, like, all right, let's go. It's like, Jesus.
It's like Austin Powers.
And then two scenes later, he's sleeping with another woman. It's wild. It's crazy, dude. I would say 1972.
69.
Was it 69? Yeah. I was like, is it the 60s? But yeah, thinking about the film quality, 1960s. All right. Now we're on to movie pop quiz time.
Let's go.
Christopher Nolan's brother, Jonathan Nolan, has written or co-written four of Christopher Nolan's film's screenplays. What are the four scripts?
Written or co-written?
Yeah.
Okay. So obviously Prestige.
One.
Dark Knight.
Two.
Interstellar.
Three.
One more. Does adapted count?
Adapted? What do you mean?
Because Memento Mori, he didn't write Memento, but it was adapted from
Memento. Go back to the question. I said screenplay.
Okay, so written or co-written. It's got to be... Did he co-write Dark Knight Rises?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Nice. I didn't think he did.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I shouldn't have given you that because it was a question. But I'll give it to you. But actually, I thought I could trick you with Memento. He wrote the short story, but he didn't write the script. So yeah,
didn't trick me.
Yeah, I almost got you.
No, you didn't.
That was good,
though.
You
didn't even come close to getting me.
Well, you know what? I shouldn't have even said that.
I get the job back. For getting that right.
What's your pop quiz?
In what movie did Hugh Jackman play a pirate?
A pirate? He's not in any of the Peter Pan movies, is he? He is, isn't he? He is in... Which Peter Pan movie is it?
Gotta get it right.
Crap. Not the Robin Williams one.
No, he's
in
Hook. Young.
Yeah,
that's the Robin Williams one. Dustin Hoffman played Hook in Hook.
Peter Pan. The Lost Boys. What are they called?
That's what they're called, yeah.
I don't know.
Pan.
Oh, god damn it. It's just one
You're
word.
Pretty much right.
Yeah. He could have given it to me. I gave you Dark Knight Rises.
I got it.
No, you answered the Dark Knight Rises. Is it? Yeah.
No, it was an answer than the phrasing of a question.
It wasn't what is. What is the Dark Knight Rises?
He played Blackbeard in Pan.
Yeah, you're right. Cool. I almost got it. Biggest hater of the week. So we posted a video of just explaining Hereditary, which we just did an episode on with Midsommar. We made a clip, 60 seconds, Hereditary explained in 60 seconds. It's a great
clip.
A lot of people are still confused by that movie, and you can tell by the comments, and that was a banger of a video. But a bunch of people, one specifically, like went off the chain. I'm not going to say their username, but they wrote like, how did you not get this? Did you even watch the movie? Like, how did you guys not understand this? Now, I wanted to just be like, I didn't respond, but we're a film podcast. We talk about movies. We analyze plots. That's what we do. What the hell else do you want us to talk about besides film stuff?
I also think that people like that are bullshitting.
When they say,
like, how did you not get this? I feel like they're just trying to act smart and powerful. Like, oh, I understood this. Whereas, like, clearly a lot of people... really enjoyed our explanation of it and found it helpful to them understanding the movie.
It's a complicated ending.
Yeah, it's a very complex movie, and it took me a few watches to understand it fully, and so I think that they're completely full of shit, honestly.
I agree.
Yeah.
All right, do you have a hater?
Oh, yeah, I got a hater. Let me pull up this hater. I think they might unsubscribe.
Hold on, I'm going to do water real quick. Good one.
I posted a clip on what's the movie? Gunpowder Milkshake.
Mm-hmm.
About the three fairies and how each of the three aunts in the movie, they have the same colors as the three fairies from Sleeping Beauty. And Damon Lamont 1016 wrote, I'm colorblind, I'm triggered, unsubscribed.
That's a good one.
I cracked up. That was funny.
Our biggest supporter of the week is a 5-star review from This App Stinks 123. Best podcast running. Absolutely love the podcast. However, would really love if you guys could watch and review the Escape Room movies. Maybe we will someday.
Yeah,
they're
them,
really
yeah.
twisted. Would love for you guys to piece them together. But thank you so much for the 5-star review and the kind words. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
And on this day in film history, today is August 12th. In 1927, Wings, one of only two silent films to be nominated for Best Picture, the other is The Artist in 2011, opened starring Clara Bow. And also for films that were released, we have Sausage Party in 2016, which is a very funny movie. Four Brothers, released in 2005, 30 Minutes or Less, released in 2011, and nothing really else great besides that. Streaming recommendations, I have Hotel Rwanda on Amazon Prime. This tells the story of the Hutu genocide of the Tutsis in Rwanda, Africa, which happened over the course of just 100 days in 1994. It's a horrific, tragic story. 800,000 people were killed in Rwanda by the Hutu extremists, and it stars Don Cheadle. Very, very powerful film. It's really emotional, but it's very historic, and I think it's an important movie to watch to understand the history of what happened.
Yeah, great rec. My recommendation is Only Lovers Left Alive on Amazon Prime.
Good choice.
Which is a fantastic vampire movie. Stars Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston as vampire lovers who have been living throughout the past centuries, trying to like understand their place in the world and adapt to the changing times. And it's a very dark comedy. It has a great style and tone to it. And just watching them on screen together is great.
All right, let's get back into The Prestige. Are you watching closely? And so what would we leave off on? So we were talking about Angier and his trick and how he was getting
Borden,
it going.
And Borden couldn't understand how he did it.
And so Angier and went Sarah, to great yeah. depths to try to copy and make better Alfred Borden's trick, the Transport of Man, which he eventually does when he makes the copies of himself to create the Transport of Man.
You could say he perfects it.
He perfects it, yeah. He makes a much better performance and act. Because what he never understood, even though Cutter told him right to his face, even though Olivia tells him that I've been backstage, I haven't seen the double, but he's using a double, it's the only way he can do it. He never understood that it was a simple trick. It was something simple as identical twins. Mm. So Alfred Borden is an identical twin. He has been his entire life, obviously. But he and his brother Freddie, so there's Alfred and Freddie, they have been living this entire life basically of a magical act to protect their secret to create the Transported Man. So,
and in the book, their names are Albert and Frederick, mm-hmm. but we're gonna call them Freddy and Albert because Olivia calls the other twin Freddy as a way of.
They also call him Alfred.
Yeah,
they never call him Albert in the movie.
Yeah,
so it's Alfred, exactly, yeah. Alfred and Freddy, and so this explains so much, especially the dual personalities that not only Angier is reading about in his book when he's talking about one minute he says this, the next minute he's talking about that. How can you not remember what knot he tied? And same thing with Olivia. Freddy loves Olivia, whereas Alfred loves Sarah. But this also ties to all the times where Sarah's like, today you love me, and I can see that, or today you don't love me, because whenever she's with the Borden that doesn't love her, that's Freddy. When she's with the Borden that does love her, that's her true husband, Alfred.
And Fallon is always played by the twin that isn't pretending to be Alfred that day. So they take turns playing Alfred and Fallon. So while Freddy is Fallon, Albert is Alfred, and while Alfred is Alfred, and then when Alfred is Fallon, then Freddy is Albert.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's really unfortunate because at the end of the film, this is when, you know, Alfred's confessing to Angier his secret and how simple it was. And he's explaining to them, Alfred and Freddy, they lived two halves of a life, and that was enough for them. But it wasn't enough for Sarah. It wasn't enough for Olivia. And it probably wasn't enough for Jess either. And Jess is Alfred's daughter, not Freddy's daughter.
I would say that it's possible that Freddy never was sexually intimate with Sarah.
Oh, 100% wasn't.
And then likewise, Alfred was never sexually intimate with Olivia.
I 100% agree. Yeah. That's why when Olivia goes to kiss Alfred that one time, he turns away because it's Alfred, not Freddy. And you can tell that he's done this multiple times. And she says that thing like, what do I tell you? When you're here with me, you're with me.
When you're with me, you're with me.
Leave your family at home, kid.
That's is she from Brooklyn now?
I don't know. This, the city accent just came out of me.
From Long Island?
That sounded more Boston. Come on, kid. I'm going home soon, kid.
But the thing with the twins is they are in love with magic. And they understood that in order to create this trick that would have been the masterpiece of their career, they would have had to commit to the trick completely and dedicate their lives to it. And by
just like Cheng Su Li.
Yeah, exactly. And they understood that in order for the trick to work would be to use them as twins. And actually, this was a trick that twins used a lot, actually, at this time. The duplicate, having a double as a twin, was actually used a lot. And I just repeated myself.
You're fired, man. You're losing your job again.
I'm done.
Who wants the opening? You'll find it on Craigslist tomorrow. Need new podcast host. Less funny, though.
But for them, their love of magic is so intense that they're willing to sacrifice having a full life of their own in order to implement carrying out the trick. And so, obviously, you and I, sharing a life would not be adequate.
Dude, sharing a bedroom till 15 was enough.
Yeah, no way. But for them, their dedication to the craft, like, they're willing to just live half a life. They're willing to just live half of their days as Alfred and half of their days as Fallon, and then the other half of their days as Freddy. And
honestly, probably a nice break.
Yeah.
Gotta get away from my kid tonight.
Except for, like, you know, destroying your marriage.
Yeah, that's it's a joke. And causing the suicide of Sarah. It's terrible.
But that's what he always tells Angier about, not understanding the sacrifice and dedication it takes to make a great trick like that work, where they have dedicated their lives for, I mean, who knows, maybe 5 or 6 years before they even met Sarah.
Yeah, so I won't talk about it too much, but in the book it talks about how they went and forged records to make it seem to make the past of them being twins invisible.
Okay, got it.
So it's probably something they've been working on for at least half a decade, like you said. And in terms of sacrifice, not only are they sacrificing their lives with their significant others and families, when Alfred gets his hands shut off, which you can probably argue is probably Freddy, because in my opinion, Freddy's the more reckless one.
Let's talk about personality real quick.
Freddy's a lot more ambitious. He seems to be more playful personality.
He's very Freddy's impulsive. He is short-tempered, a little bit more selfish, and a little bit more arrogant than Alfred is.
And Alfred's more reserved. He's probably more of the thinker in terms of the acts. That's why when Alfred's yelling at him, like after they see Angier's perfect act, he's like, "How come you can't outthink him?"
That's Freddy yelling at Alfred,
yeah.
dressed as Borden. I mean, Fallon. And Alfred seems to be just like more modest, more kind-hearted. Mm-hmm. Not to say that Freddy is bad, but he just has worse personality traits, not to the extreme, but just the characteristics that contrasted with Alfred.
And I think a great shot to show this is the first time when he's talking to Olivia in her interview, really, of her confessing to him what Angier told her to say. He has that very, like, loving look, like, "I'm very attracted to you," and they both have that look for each
other. Yeah, they're flirting.
Whereas Alfred really never has that for Sarah because, again, he's a very modest and humble person, so he's obviously attracted to his wife, but it's different.
Exactly, like, when he drops her off at her house, at her apartment after they get lunch, he asks, like, are you going to invite me in
for tea? Keeps his distance.
But he's also very reserved and, like, yeah, very respectful of her space.
Despite breaking inside her room.
Well, Freddie breaks inside of her room.
Oh, yeah. That's
what
right.
happens.
Yeah.
So she enters her apartment, and then Freddie's already inside with the teapot ready. And you can just tell from the way Freddie's laughing, he seems to be more rambunctious as well.
Yeah, you're right. It's actually a great point. And the laugh is different than Alfred's, for sure.
Exactly.
And another point of sacrifice is when they're doing the bullet trick, which I was talking about a second ago, which is probably Freddy as the professor, because this is the trick that he really wants to do. You can tell because he's that crazy ambitious one. And Angier shoots off two of his fingers. In order to keep the trick alive for the transported man, the other one's going to have two of his fingers removed. And so it's a really horrific scene where, thank God they don't show it, but he has to cut off his fingers with the hammer.
Nolan always does a great job with off-screen violence and gore. He like the Joker slicing people up. You never see it, but you feel it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And another great instance, a hint of it, is when Sarah tells Alfred that she's pregnant and he goes, "Oh, we got to tell Fallon."
Yeah.
It's actually Freddy saying, "I need to tell Alfred because it's his son."
Yeah.
It's obviously not my son, so he needs to know this right away.
Yeah. And he also seems like kind of excited, but like his excitement is like
an uncle excitement. Yeah,
yeah. So it's different than an actual father. And the thing with, what was I just about to say? Okay, so, and this is a very clear distinction that we're trying to make, where the personalities are different between Alfred and Freddy, which is proves to people another common myth that Alfred and Freddy are not copies. They're not duplicates. They didn't get a machine from Tesla. They're identical twins. They're different personalities. The different women they love, those are proof that they're not copies. They were never copied in the past, whereas Angier is an exact copy of every Angier in the future.
And what confuses people is the diary keyword. And so when Alfred gives the keyword to Angier for his diary so that he can translate it, he tells him the keyword is Tesla, and Tesla is the method. And so what he's doing is he's leading Angier on a false trail. Yes, the keyword was Tesla, but Tesla was not the method to the transporter man for Alfred. Alfred's method, like we said, was identical twins. But he knows that if he says Tesla was the method, Angier will go to Colorado and spend a fortune trying to figure out a way of creating his own version of the trick and probably waste away in Colorado.
Misdirection.
Yeah.
It's throughout the entire film. This is a perfect case
of
this
trick.
This is a trick.
Yeah.
It's all misdirection, but obviously we learn that Angier and Tesla create an apparatus to copy himself. And so, but it's also to reiterate the fact that they're identical twins. There's a literal line in the film where it says, Tesla never made a machine for anybody. And that's what Angier says to Allie. He's like, Tesla made a machine for Allie. And Allie's like, I never said that.
Yeah.
You said that. We never said that.
So Tesla and Allie were even taking advantage of Angier. Because,
exactly.
Because they lost their funding from the government. And so they needed a new influx of cash. And so Angier showing up was the perfect thing for them, where they pretended to make it seem like, oh, yeah, we did kind of, we know what you're talking about in terms of a machine.
We could probably
whip
something
it up
for you.
But they never did. They needed his money. And they knew that Angier pumping them with money would save their endeavor.
Unfortunately, Tesla's a genius that he figured out how to make copies of something.
Yeah.
And so that's Alfred's trick. Again, identical twins. You can believe us if you're not. That is 100% a fact of this story.
And there's another clue. Jess, when he first meets Jess and Sarah, and Alfred shows her the bird in the cage, saying like, "Hey, it's okay, he's still alive."
Oh, no, it's not Jess. It's her nephew.
I'm sorry, the nephew. And he's like, "The bird's okay, don't worry." And then he goes, "But what about his brother?" And so that's a hint that Alfred is a brother.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you brought up the bird trick, because I'm going to relate the metaphor of the bird trick that Cutter does in the opening of the film to the secret behind Angier's film. So,
I'm so excited.
So we got... Why is this? So another very big misconception of this film is whether or not Angier is the person that goes below the stage, or that is at the end is the prestige. And so...
Because he says the line, it took courage to not know whether I'd be the person in the box or the person on the stage.
So this is how Angier's trick works. His apparatus, it creates a exact copy of himself. Again, every memory, every experience up to that second of the copy and duplication, it's Angier. And so the copy of Angier from the machine has been projected to a certain location off stage in the balcony. So he actually is able to coordinate where that's going to go. Same thing with the hats and same thing with the cat. They just have to calibrate it to what direction and how far away they want it. And so every night, Angier goes inside the apparatus, kills himself while he gets copied by the machine when all the lightning's going around him. He falls under stage, dies, kills himself,
drowns.
And drowns. And the copy is the one on the balcony. And then the next night, that copy that was at the end of the trick, the copy that was the prestige of the trick from the night before, he goes on stage the next night, he kills himself and creates a copy. And that copy is now the new Angier on the balcony. So it's a never-ending cycle of only copies. So Angier, the original Angier, died the first time he performed the real transported man on stage. The first night he drowned, that was the original Angier. From then on, it's just copy after copy.
And so technically, Angier is both the man in the box and the man on the stage.
And that's why it's a great line, because I think it makes people think so much. It's like, it took courage not knowing if I was going to die or be on the stage. It's because every copy thinks they're Angier. Of course you're going to go on that stage and be like, I hope I'm not the one that's going to be in the box and drown to death, because why would I do that to myself when really that's what I'm doing?
Because technically he doesn't know for sure how it works. He doesn't know, am I being transported there a copy is replacing me on stage, or I'm being put under the stage to drown and the copy is putting out there.
Exactly.
So he doesn't know for sure himself how it works, because both are Angier completely, wholeheartedly, soul, mind, and body.
Yes, but again, it's a never-ending cycle. He dies, kills himself, creates a copy, which is in the balcony, and that balcony copy does the same thing over and over again. And so I think we just said it three times. Yeah. If you haven't grasped it yet, rewind about 5 minutes.
And that's why even though the copy takes over every night, he is the same person. So that's why he stashes the old body and puts it into the other arena that's hidden, and he has the stagehand. So he carries out the endeavor over and over again because he is Angier.
And again, another example of proof that this is true and that we're right is the bird trick. We are right. This is the bird trick with Cutter in the opening of the film. What is the bird trick? There's the bird in the cage. Cutter puts the blanket on top of the cage, smashes the cage down, and it disappears inside the table. And that bird in the table is dead. And so what's he do? He pulls out a different bird that looks exactly the same out of his pocket and brings the bird back to life. So the bird dies, and a new one is brought out. Same thing with Angier's trick. Angier dies, his copy is brought out.
It's exactly. And the only difference is those birds are not copies of each other, but they look identical. Whereas Angier is literally copying himself, but that is the perfect translation for what Angier is doing.
It's so obvious. Yeah. I'm telling you, every time you watch a Nolan movie, the first 3 minutes, he's telling you the rules.
Exactly. And one of my favorite shots is there's another way in which Nolan and cinematographer Wally Pfister relay the parallel between the birds and Angier and his copies is, so the ending shot is Alfred arrives at the theater basement and finds Angier, shoots him, and then he tells Angier how he did his trick, that he's an identical twin and that his twin Freddy just is dead, but he's still alive. And then he sees...
Yeah, so Freddy's the one in prison.
Yeah, Freddy's the one who hangs, and Alfred's the one who survives. Rightfully so, because his daughter Jess is the one who needs the real father. He deserves to be with her. And then also Freddy, it's his own fault, his own ambition and arrogance and greed, which is what got him caught in the first place by trying to see how Angier was performing his trick and going backstage.
Even though Alfred told him to leave it alone.
Yeah, Alfred's the one who told him, like, leave it alone, leave him to his trick.
Forget it.
Forget it.
We're done.
We're done. But Freddy couldn't help himself. So Freddy's the one who's in prison. And at the end, Alfred sees all these water tanks with the copies of Angier. And then he tells him, like, you spent a fortune, you did really terrible things.
You did terrible things.
Terrible things. And then the fire begins, Angier dies and the fire starts, and then Borden leaves. And then the last shot we see is the camera pans to the left, and it goes to a close-up of one of the tanks, and we see the exact copy of Angier dead in the water. And there are the tanks behind it, right? So there's like a dozen tanks behind it. And Chris Nolan did the exact same shot in the bird cages where he shot there's a whole wall of cages of birds, and he does the same side shot from one bird cage at the front, and you can see the other birds in the distance in the foreground lined up behind it.
Great point.
Exact same shot showing that there are a bunch of copies of these birds, just like how there are a bunch of copies of Angier.
And so fortunately, Cutter kind of basically understands what's happening, and because he meets Lord Caldwell. So after Tesla is basically run out of town by the American government and Edison's men, they burn down his factory, Angier is given the box by the hotel managers. I didn't think it was necessary to tell Edison's people about the box. What's in the box?
What's in the box?
What's in the box? He says box, right?
Yeah.
And so...
No, he says, what's in the box?
I just lost my train of thought. What was I saying?
Angier in the box.
No, before that.
Cutter.
Okay, so Cutter...
It's like one sentence.
I lost my... What was I saying?
You were talking about how he didn't know that Tesla left him in the box.
Okay. I still think I lost what I was talking about. It just escaped me, man.
I don't know what you were going to say.
Oh, it was probably going to be not that interesting.
You messed yourself up by doing the what's in the box.
What's in the box? I couldn't help myself, man. I never can with a box joke.
We reference it like every other episode.
Every other day, too. Hold on. Like, give me a second. It might come to me. Either way, so Cutter learns basically what's happening in a way, and so Lord Caldwell is the one who purchases all the boxes and apparatus that Angier left behind in Edison and Tesla as well, and that's where Cutter is able to accidentally, on purpose, meet Caldwell, and learns that it's Angier, and he sees him for the first time. He's like, I saw you dead. You were on a slab. And because of this, Cutter has a change of heart where Angier's clearly done something terrible. He has no idea what he's done yet, but it's impossible for him to be alive when he saw him dead. And not only that, is he has Alfred's son, I mean daughter, Jess, and she's taking care of him, and she deserves to be with her real father. And so, because I think Cutter's so clever, he knew that they had to be identical twins. He knew he had to be using a double, and that's where he works with Alfred to get Jess to Alfred and then also give Alfred access to the basement under the stage.
Yeah, because what Angier did was horrible, a truly villainous act to take a father from his daughter and to let him hang for a crime he didn't commit. And I think Cutter definitely felt a lot of guilt because he played a major part in the actual trial by helping to convict Alfred.
He also, I think he should have some guilt on his conscience as well because of when Julia died, and he tried to comfort Angier by telling him that he knew a sailor once who drowned but came back to life 5 minutes later, and he said that drowning was like going to sleep,
going
right?
Home.
It was like going home.
Have you even seen the movie?
It was peaceful.
Going to sleep?
Someone's got like, I think I was quoting Sirius Black. Faster than falling asleep.
We're right here.
and so that comforts Angier, and I think that is what lets Angier, gives him courage to do something horrible in terms of drowning himself every night, thinking that if I'm going to have to kill myself, I might as well do something where, like Cutter says, it's like going home. But then the last thing that Cutter says to Angier is he says that, I did lie to you. I said that it's like going home, but what really happens is when you drown, it's agony.
It's agony.
So, and then there's that look on Angier's face, and he kind of like clears the dust away from one of the tanks. He's like, what have I done? But also in his heart, I don't think he really cares that much.
The thing with Angier's situation is he didn't have to kill the first copy. They could have lived as Angier and performed the trick perfectly.
That's a great point.
But I think it would have worked the same. He didn't have to keep killing copies of himself and keep killing himself and creating copies. Like, it could have just been two Angiers. It would have been perfect and fine. But the thing with Angier is what makes him so different from Alfred and Freddy is he's unwilling to share the glory. He's unwilling to share it. Whereas Alfred and Freddy, half a life is good enough. We can share the trick. We're modest enough. We're just doing the trick is enough for us, and we can share the load and share the glory and the attention. Whereas Angier, he wanted the wealth, he wanted the power,
he wants to be the prestige every night.
He wants to be in front of the crowd, so that's why he set it up to kill the copy every time.
And also, I think the first time he kills the first copy is he doesn't understand what's going to happen. I'm sure he's terrified. He's like, I got to kill this dude. He looks just like me.
Yeah, exactly. But then the next one, he could have been like talking to him, just like see what's going on.
Bro,
like,
what am I thinking right now?
But instead, he's like straight murking himself over and over again.
Yeah.
But that's the major personality difference between Angier and the twins.
Oh, such a good movie.
Yeah, it's great, man.
It's a great ending, too.
Phenomenal ending.
Oh, man, I think we're done.
We went to town explaining that.
Yeah, man. That's such a good movie. It's so fun.
Want to do some trivia?
Yeah, let's do some trivia.
Sweet.
So Chung Ling Su was actually a stage character created by William Ellsworth Robinson, a white man who disguised himself as a Chinese man to cash in on audience's enthusiasm for the exotic. Robinson lived as Chung, never breaking character while in public. He died in March 1918 when a bullet catch trick went wrong. My God, I've been shot, were both his last and first English words spoken on stage in 19 years.
The irony.
Crazy.
The word prestige originally meant a trick from the Latin prestigium, meaning illusion.
Nikola Tesla was a world-renowned inventor, physicist, and engineer, and for a while he did conduct extreme electrical experiments at his lab in Colorado Springs, where he was also known for his eccentric behavior.
The main characters, Alfred Borden and Robert Angier, spell the word abra as an abracadabra, a common word used by magicians.
The prestige includes 164... Hold on, let me say this again. The editing in The Prestige includes 146 time jump cuts in which the next shot either flashes back or skips ahead to another period in time of the storyline. This averages to almost one timeline jump per minute of the movie, so you really have to pay attention.
There is a hint in this movie, and it is confirmed in the novel, that the twins are named Albert and Frederick Borden. Hence, they combine their names, Al and Fred, to create Alfred Borden.
Sam Mendes actually wanted to do this movie as a follow-up to American Beauty, which had just been nominated for 7 Academy Awards. When another offer came from New Market Films on behalf of writer, producer, and director Christopher Nolan, of whom author Christopher Priest had never heard of, Priest was prepared to close the deal with Mendez when a VHS copy of Nolan's film Following, which was released in 1998, was delivered to his house by motorcycle. Priest was impressed and chose Nolan to do the film.
He also wanted to help a up-and-coming filmmaker rather than an established one.
Plus, Following is a tremendous debut for such a low budget, like $10,000.
Yeah, it's great. That's it for my trivia. You got any more?
Nah, I think that's it.
Want to do some superlatives?
Let's do it.
Who is your MVP?
I got Hugh Jackman. I think he's just really great in this
movie. I did too. Yeah, he's sensational.
Obviously, everyone else is really good, but I think this is, like you said, Hugh Jackman's probably best performance.
Mm-hmm. Best scene.
I want to say the just the confession at the end where we finally learn all of Borden's truths about him being an identical twin, and also the, basically watching Angier, you could say, get what he deserves in the end.
So did I, the ending.
Yeah.
What's the best shot?
I actually couldn't pick one. There's so many to choose from. But if I have to on the spot, on the top of my head, pick one, I think I would pick something after you tell me yours.
Someone didn't need to prepare. I picked the final shot of the reveal of the copy of Angier.
Yeah, so is it the camera, it zooms, it pulls out and then goes left, right? Or is it a,
no,
pan,
just,
is it
just,
a pan left?
Yeah, it just goes.
Is it a pan left? Or is it a track left?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yes, it's a really, I never even picked up on the birdcage thing that you brought up earlier. I was like, wow, I know exactly. When you were talking about it, I'm like, I never picked up on that.
Yeah, I know. I know a few things.
Wicked smart kid.
I read it in a book.
In a book. All right, favorite shot, probably.
Let's go, man.
I think
the people are waiting.
When Tesla walks through the electricity.
That's a cool shot.
It's pretty badass.
That's a pretty cool shot. It's a great cool. entrance. It seems like something David Bowie would do on stage.
I know, right?
What's the best line?
Are you watching closely?
Nice. Mine was, it was the look on their faces.
That's it.
Wow. That was a lot of fun. I love doing Nolan movies.
Yeah.
The Prestige, a fantastic movie.
Hope you all enjoyed this film.
And if you were a little confused about the movie, we hope you helped. We helped you understand it better. And if
trust us, we're right.
Yeah, we're right. We're correct. And if you already knew it, we hope you enjoyed the review.
Yeah, and make sure to go to patreon.com/Raiders of Lost Podcast to help support the show. $2, $5, $10 tiers. That's all it costs. And you get access to all exclusive features, including bonus episodes every single Tuesday.
It goes a long way to helping us out.
Thanks so much for tuning in, everybody around the world.
Take care.
Bye.
Are you watching closely?
Are you watching closely? Raiders of the Lost Podcast is a Mirror Image production. Sound mixing done by Jacob Kosler. Opening music by Chase Jackson.